Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Andrew Bashago right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We'll take your phone calls with Andrew. Andrew, you were talking about Bill Clinton, and your father hit it right on the head, didn't he?
He certainly did. In fact, he mentioned it again. We were camping at Mount Shasta in the late 70s, and he asked my brother and I what the future would hold. And I think I said that that flying car featured in Star Wars would become dominant by the time I was an adult. And he said, well, boys, I can tell you this. One of our next future presidents is going to be Bill Clinton. And I really wasn't thinking about my project experiences as a youngster, even there in my late teens or mid-teens. And we found that statement so funny that we actually fell off the picnic table bench laughing at his statement that somebody named Bill Clinton was going to be president. But that, in fact, was sort of the strange culture we were living in there when I was, you know, sort of having these parallel experiences. I had a very wonderful and happy childhood growing up in New Jersey, but I had essentially been involved in, you know, the cult of intelligence at a very young age. And I think I repressed a lot of it. And so even by my mid or late teens, I was already not really connecting that kind of statement back to things I had heard when I was on the project as a 7, 8, 9-year-old. But I also might, I'd like to add also that I mentioned President Obama. That's a little bit stranger, and I think may even indicate that the hand of the Almighty in some way has been involved in furthering my truth campaign. I mentioned President Obama. Now, the strange thing about that is I met President Obama when I was an undergraduate at UCLA. I don't have the precise date, but we know it was either the spring or summer break of 1982, because I had interviewed Buckminster Fuller in fall of 81, and my meeting with the young Barack Obama occurred before he graduated from Columbia in summer of 83. I was having a discussion with a South African anti-apartheid activist on Bruin Walk, and I was sharing with him some of my thoughts in political economy, particularly the direction that the transnational corporations would be taking over the next several decades. And he said, listen, I have a house guest I'd like to introduce you to. I think he'd be fascinated by what you have to say about what Bucky Fuller shared with you and some of your ideas in political economy. And so I went with this individual over to his house in West Los Angeles. And I had a discussion that lasted about a half hour with a young student who was back in Los Angeles after having spent a year at Columbia. And he explained to me that his name was Barack Obama and that he was in L.A. Visiting his friends from his 2 years at Occidental College in Eagle Rock, California. Mm-hmm. And our discussion about the corporations, I was taking a much more radical take on where the corporations were going, the possibility that they might enslave humanity, destroy the environment. Barack Obama was taking a much more sort of liberal position that they were necessary institutions in society, a much more lawyerly analysis. And so our conversation unraveled essentially into an argument. And our host said to me, you better be nice to him, Andy, because he's going to be president of the United States someday. So the incredibly serendipitous thing is that as somebody, I mean, I'm sure that neither of them at the time understood that ultimately I would be able to make sense of that comment, because I, in fact, had previously in my life been one of the children attached to the very classified defense-related research and development program where quantum access technologies were developed that would allow the U.S. government to identify a particular person of interest like a future president and literally approach them and brief them. But clearly, now Barack Obama was born in August of 61, myself in September of 61. We're literal contemporaries. And that meeting with President Obama occurred when we were 20 years old. So in the case of President Obama, he had 27 years to prepare psychologically for the presidency. I presume he must have been briefed by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was his mentor at Columbia. Zbigniew Brzezinski had just served as national security advisor for President Carter.
He sure was.
And
surely a globalist, Andy.
Yes, and I know I can date it to that time frame, so that indicates that after spending a year at Columbia, by that time, a young Barack Obama had already been approached by our government and at least informed about his destiny. You know, in a similar way, I was informed of my destiny as somebody who would be principally associated in society with the discovery of life on Mars, not simply because I was told that when I was a child attached to Project Pegasus, but I was shown and asked to read my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, that I published last year in 1971. I was shown the 2008 version and required to read it. And when I asked, well, why do I have to read this paper that I'm going to write, you know, 37 years from now, they said, so that when you do write it, it contains as much data about Mars as possible. So I think the significance of these experiences is that there was some attempt that was being made to take information from the future and use it in the present to channel certain outcomes that they either thought were beneficial for the country or that would help the people involved in carrying out very serious responsibilities on behalf of the country, like the president. But it is a pretty profound implication of my story, and it's true, and I think we have to do a lot of soul-searching and maybe even hold a national debate as a society. What are we going to do now about the presidency, now that we know that the presidents, in fact, have been given prior knowledge of their destinies as president? It's an incredibly complicated thing to resolve politically and philosophically.
Absolutely. Okay, to the phones we go. This hour will go by very quickly. East of the Rockies, Boston, Mass, we go. Hello, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to speak with you and your guest. I have a question about the holographic film that your guest viewed on Jesus. And I know in another show it was mentioned that according to the police arrest report of Jesus was on the internet, and they give descriptions when they arrest someone, and he was listed as 4'8" and a hunchback. And I just wanted to know if this is true, or did he look, more like what they depict in photo, paintings of him, and things like that.
That's a fascinating question. The individual being crucified in the hologram, or actually it was a documentary, black and white documentary film of a hologram of somebody from that era being crucified. They had concluded it was Jesus of Nazareth, but of course there were something like 600 men of Jesus' time and age who in fact were executed in that way during the period when he was crucified. The individual in the film was very emaciated. He had black hair and a beard. He was essentially a European male with a sort of an aquiline nose and slightly droopy eyes. Not unlike, in fact, Sylvester Stallone's, but he was in a great deal of anguish as a result of dying in that manner. The reason I do believe it was Jesus of Nazareth is a number of things that occurred during the film were right out of the gospel accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus, including the Roman centurion Longinus leaping up actually on 1 foot, because the individual being crucified was on about 14 feet off the ground. And so Longinus took the end of his spear and actually speared the side of the individual being crucified. There were also women who were coming and praying at the foot of the cross. And so I'm not sharing this information to advocate a particular religious interpretation of the events, but the film I saw definitely closely followed the scriptural account of Jesus' crucifixion.
Okay, let's go to Springfield, Mass. First-time caller. Andy, go ahead. You're on with us.
Hi, I just have 3 questions. For the guest?
3?
Well,
let's go one at a time.
Okay. You say that there's time travel, so does that mean that there's, like, time cops for, like, maybe rogue agents that decide that they're going to go off and do other things?
All right. That's question 1, Andy.
I have no knowledge of time cops, but I do know that in one of the seminars about teleportation, one of the reasons that the program gave for not introducing the technology socially was the concern that rogue elements, or in fact they mentioned organized criminal networks, would get hold of the technology and improve it, and in that way oppress society by, for example, committing crimes and then teleporting elsewhere to evade arrest. So certainly the issue of policing teleportation was within the contemplation of the program sponsors, but I don't remember the notion of time cops ever being articulated any further than that.
All right, number 2, Andy.
Was Gene Roddenberry the creator of Star Trek from the future?
I don't know. I think one thing I can add to the discussion of science fiction is that it's a literary genre that was partially developed by the U.S. intelligence community and military to take information from real clandestine projects and place them in fictional accounts so that the public would either be confused about the nature of things like new technical developments that were being kept secret, or if somebody who had been an insider pointed to their to the technology or described their experiences, their accounts could be attributed to a fictional genre. So, for example, with Star Trek, they were revealing a teleportation technology right around the time that it, in fact, emerged in the defense technical community in the United States, but they were depicting a form of teleportation that was literally the opposite of the teleportation technology that had been developed. But I don't have any information suggesting that the brilliant Gene Roddenberry was anything more than a great creative mind from our own time.
And your last one, Andy?
Is there any way I can get involved?
Oh, now that's a good question, too. How does he get involved?
Well, my Mars research project is at www.projectmars.net. I would urge you to become a supporter and participant in Mars. And my truth campaign, Project Pegasus, is at www.projectpegasus.net. And so I would urge you to visit those websites and join my campaign. Also, I'm up on Facebook. We have two groups, one Project Pegasus and the other entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars on Facebook, and you can keep abreast of my truth campaign on those two sites on Facebook.
Okay, next up, we go to John in Sun City, California. You're up with us. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, other than maybe giving me some lotto numbers in the future, I have a question regarding needing Rumsfeld and Richardson to confirm what you were saying. Wouldn't it be simpler, since the chances of them doing so is very nil? Couldn't you write something down, since you know of these other things, like Clinton and Bush's being made president, your knowledge of some of the things in the future, in the near future, write it down, put it in a vault somewhere, like with George, and then unlock it in 6 months or a year, and say that these six or eight things that you said would happen 6 months earlier came true? Wouldn't that be proof enough that what you're saying is confirmation?
Well, this idea comes up, and I'm sort of asked to prove my claims by being a soothsayer. Let me just say this. My project experiences on Project Pegasus occurred 40 years ago when I was age 7 to 11. I'm now 48. I've spent the last 10 years investigating what happened to me and writing down as much as I can remember. Things like being able to correlate the one lunch in 1971 when both President Bush's were present and apparently had recently been briefed on their presidencies are just one episode in an entire lifetime that I've been able to go back and identify as having happened on the project as a result of doing literally 10 years worth of memory work. So I think that's a very logical question that you ask, but it's not a requirement that I'm going to impose on myself, because my account is really a memoir that I've recovered from the recesses of my own life experience 4 decades ago. And in fact, if I had not gone about the process of recovering the memories, that is to say, focusing on them for 10 years, I'm not sure I would have been able to correlate much of the information. I would have simply forgotten it and moved on with my career as a lawyer and as a writer. So I don't want to position myself as a soothsayer, because essentially I've been able to identify the things that were predicted about the future because they were referenced in discussions 40 years ago, and I've done the memory work to recover them. But I'm not prepared, for example, to say who the next president is going to be.
Can you say, Andy, whether we get hit by an asteroid or anything like that?
Well, there was catastrophic information that was revealed in one of the time probes. Let me describe it. I don't remember anything involving being struck by an object from space. But there was a very, very basically dangerous chronovisor probe that was undertaken on November 5th of 1971 at the ITT Defense Communications Facility in Nutley, New Jersey, which then and now is literally physically adjacent to the Defense Logistics Agency branch that's there in Nutley, New Jersey. And for that probe to the future, there was such a high-intensity light generated by the crystal array in the chronovisor that we actually had to wear a crystal helmet and a protective spacesuit-like garb that was sputter-coated with titanium to literally physically protect us from the energy field that we were placed in. During that probe, we went forward for about a half hour to remotely view the status of the U.S. Supreme Court building as it would appear on the Mall in Washington, D.C. in the year 2013. And I do believe that year was selected because of the concern regarding the Mayan prophecy and what may befall us, on December 21st of 2012. And what I saw during that probe and reported to the lieutenant commander from the Office of Naval Intelligence, who debriefed me when my clothing was removed on the stage, my boots were poured out, not, I believe, from water, but actually my own perspiration. It was so hot in that suit. I was taken down the hall, and the lieutenant commander from ONI asked me, okay, Andy, tell me about the target. The target is what we had been trained at some exercises at Curtis Wright to actually focus on and look quickly to the left and right when the forward momentum of this particular probe stopped. And essentially what this was that event as it was forming prior to the collapse of the wave function in that area of the quantum hologram where that future event on that timeline was stored but had not yet occurred from the perspective of our position in the time-space continuum. And what I saw and reported to the Office of Naval Intelligence is that the U.S. Supreme Court building was under about 100 feet of brackish water. In fact, there was algae growing on the stately columns in the front of that building. But I hasten to add that we can't use that information to be apprehensive about the idea that there will be a catastrophe in 2012 involving, let's say, substantial coastal flooding that would place Washington, D.C. underwater, because all of the chronovisor probes were to adjacent timelines in the multiverse. In fact, I think something significant about my investigation that I can offer to the discussion about time travel, both in science and parascience, is that Project Pegasus proved the existence of the multiverse, the notion that the quantum hologram consists of a multiple set of adjacent timelines that are essentially similar, but that differ slightly and are sort of densely packed, internested sets of timelines. Because when I was being sent multiple times to the assassination of President Lincoln, I had been trained to go through the lobby and up the stairs and behind his box there at Ford's Theater. Every time I was sent there, something different would happen. And then later in 1971, I was present at the meeting in the evening at the Sandia Auditorium where time travel to the past involving chronovision using children was shut down. Because in the words of the administrator who was announcing the termination of that part of the program, every time we send the same child or a different child to the same event, it changes a little bit. So when I described this probe to 2013, in which clearly there had been a mass disaster, in which presumably the entire eastern seaboard had been flooded with a substantial amount of water, God knows from what, global warming, maybe the collapse of La Palma in the Canary Islands into the Atlantic, perhaps a meteor strike in one of the world's oceans. I'm saying that that information had been detected on one timeline, but that doesn't mean that we're in the timeline where that event will occur.
You're very good, Andy. I got to tell you, it's a very compelling story. We'll be back in a moment with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Craig Hewlett joins us as we talk about some major issues of the day, and we'll take your phone calls as well. By the way, in the not-too-distant future, sooner than later, we will be having the Coast to Coast Instapoll on the coasttocoastam.com website. Immediate polling questions to you about specific issues of the show or questions of the day. For example, do you believe the swine flu was concocted in a laboratory, yes or no? Through the Coast to Coast Instapoll, you'll be able to go there and say yes or no, and we'll get instant results, and we'll share them with you on the show. We'll even share them with guests who might be appropriate for that specific topic. So look for that in the not-too-distant future on the coasttocoastam.com website. And welcome back to Coast with Andrew Bashago, the attorney, the author as well. Let's take some more of your calls. You ready for the final calls, Andy?
Yes, let's fire away.
Peter in Queens, New York. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, I'd like to ask two front questions, one on Christ and the other one on DVD copies. On Christ, there have been various variations, like certain famous Catholic saints and mystics had different variations on how he really looked like. So did he look like the Holy Shroud, a Turan? What age was he? Did he have nails in his wrist or in his hands? The other question is, the great composers like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and Franz Liszt doing their own works, and Babe Ruth playing a nine-inning game in his prime in the 20s in a modern video, DVD, audio, or copy and all that. These we wouldn't get variations because we know how these individuals look like. So that's the two questions I like to ask you.
Well, the individual I saw being crucified, who the project had concluded, was Jesus of Nazareth. I think the closest depiction of him would be perhaps the El Greco rendering of Jesus. This individual was very thin, had very dark hair, aquiline features, a very narrow face, droopy eyes.
How old was he?
He looked his age.
40 years old, as the modern scholars say. He was born 4 B.C. or 6 B.C. Would you say he's about 40 or 30 or 33?
He could have been. I couldn't really say whether he was anywhere from 33 to 40, but he was certainly in that age range.
And did he have nails in his wrist like the Holy Shroud predicts or traditional?
Yes. The one thing that was conspicuous to a child who was growing up in the Roman Catholic tradition and seeing what was being purported to be the actual crucifixion of Jesus was that he wasn't on a cross. This individual was on a pole, and there was a very short cross piece that he had been nailed to through the wrists, maybe about a 3-foot cross beam on something that looked about the size of a modern telephone pole. And he was in a great deal of anguish, and that was quite disturbing to see. There was a crown of thorns. I mentioned the women who came to pray at the foot of his cross, and also the Roman centurion reaching up to lance him in the side. Let me just say in reference to your question, he did not resemble the face in the shroud at all. That individual looks much more august and robust.
But remember what you said yourself and what the saints have said themselves. There are variations. I mean, there are different variations of him. And even the saints had different, you know, Sister Aida of Spain and Catherine Emmerich, that Mel Gibson had his Passion of Christ go by. They both had different variations of Christ. And like you had said earlier, going back in the past or whatever, there was different variations of certain events or certain scenes or whatever.
Right.
And Andy, don't you also think, though, that a 40-year-old of that era would look much older than a 40-year-old of this era?
Certainly, and this individual was very emaciated and was in a great deal of pain. I would say that he certainly looked like depictions of Jesus. I would say that the actor that was cast in the Mel Gibson production, that wasn't very far off, although he looked a little bit more Mediterranean than that, or Middle Eastern.
Was that James Caviezel? I don't know how he pronounced
it. Yeah, the individual in the documentary that I was watching, of ostensibly the actual crucifixion, was more swarthy looking, more of a Middle Eastern phenotype, very thin, as if he had been starving for weeks or even longer and suffering for a great deal of time before he was crucified. Regarding the caller's second question regarding the great individuals in the past, I think that's one of the positive potentials of Chronovision that undergirds my truth campaign regarding these quantum access technologies. Imagine being able to go into the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and seeing Bach perform or seeing the U.S. Constitution being signed. I mean, we can watch modern events that have been filmed, let's say Martin Luther King giving the I Have a Dream speech, and be profoundly moved. Imagine what would happen culturally if we could go to virtual museums and libraries where a protectorate that would be in control of the Chronovision technology so that it couldn't be abused to violate people's privacy, but that would uphold a high standard of quantum access and allow the public to view different significant and inspiring moments in history. I think that would culturally be a very profound resource. So in that sense, I think we should start thinking about using these quantum access technologies to spark a cultural renaissance in our global civilization as a result of going back and viewing inspiring moments from the past, not just in American history, but in all of world history.
How did you feel about your father allowing you to go through this program? Did you ever get upset with him, or were you happy about it?
Then and now, I feel like he permitted me to enjoy a profound cosmic privilege. Certainly one of the funny scenes in the movie is going to be the fact that there was a point where I had a little temper tantrum, and I said to one of his friends in Albuquerque, he doesn't give me credit for anything. And in fact, he wasn't giving me credit for serving in a classified defense project where time travel was going on, and I was responsible for undertaking it. So we shared in a special way as father and son in the program. I think perhaps the abiding human or literary theme of my book is that we're all alive for only a brief moment in time. And the kind of interludes that I had with my father when we were serving together on Project Pegasus now have a very profound resonance with me. And I'm glad that we were able to essentially participate as father and son at the dawn of the time-space age. I view it as an incredible privilege that we had, not just as father and son, but simply as human individuals who were there at literally the inception of time travel and the time-space age. So I look back with great fondness and some sense of poignancy about the fact that my father is deceased and he can't share in this next phase of my life where I'm bringing public attention to the fact that these technologies were developed and that we should be trying to enhance their positive potential and prevent their negative potential. I think he'd be quite proud of me.
Let's go to Jennifer in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes, hello. Hi. Well, I have to ask, since we have had this technology for 40 years now, and we were able to develop it in the first place, I think common sense would say that if there are other intelligent species and civilizations out there, that they would come across this technology too. So did you meet any extraterrestrials in your time travels, and did they look human?
And that's a very complicated question. I'm going to go into some of this in the book. I had a set of contact experiences as a child with the Greys that I really don't think add a lot to the discussion about human ET contact. When I went and I plotted everything that happened in Pegasus, and then I examined where these episodes of extraterrestrial contact occurred, obviously I was examining whether my memories of having served in Project Pegasus resulted from extraterrestrial contact. I was trying to disprove that premise in the same way that I was controlling for other factors like fantasy, delusion, government mind control, mistake, and so forth. And what I ended up finding, and I think does add to the whole study of extraterrestrial or interdimensional human contact, is they seem to have been appearing as a result of the fact that I was appearing in the realm that they occupy, that they are operational in, which is the supraluminal realm of fourth and fifth dimension functioning. So I'm going to describe in the book, for example, one time I was moving forward in time in the Montauk chair. One of the quantum access technologies is the chair described in the Montauk Project books by Preston Nichols and Peter Moon, which is essentially a magnetic transducer that prompts an astral projection of a person's consciousness to subjective moments in their own personal futures. In other words, it works a form of psycho-spiritual time travel. And during one of those probes to my own future, the forward momentum stopped, and I looked to my right, and there were four gray extraterrestrials observing me, and then I continued to move forward. So I guess what I'm implying here or describing is that there seemed to be extraterrestrial or interdimensional monitoring of some of the time-space exploration activities that DARPA sent me on. And I think maybe that's a contribution to the whole discussion of who or what the extraterrestrials are and what realm of consciousness or reality they're actually functioning in. It's actually the higher time-space dimensions, I believe. I do not believe that they're necessarily biological creatures. I think they are, in fact, interdimensional creatures of a higher order.
All right, let's go to John in San Francisco. Hey, John, thanks for calling.
Oh, yeah. What an incredible program. I have a few questions. Hopefully I can get through them all real quick. George sort of touched on the first one. What did you feel about your father, you know, volunteering you for this project, top secret project, where he didn't know if you were going to come back alive or not? I mean, I find that hard to believe that you share some kind of pride with that. The second question is, you mentioned that this teleportation can help our environmental or some other civilian problems that we're experiencing here on Earth. How exactly can this technology do that? Because you didn't go into details on that. And number three, if your story is true, why are you even allowed to talk about this? I mean, this is pretty heavy-duty stuff. Aren't you concerned for your safety?
Okay, let's take first.
Okay.
Well, during my 10 years investigating what happened to me in Project Pegasus, I was definitely concerned about my safety. In fact, in the summer of 2003, during my first fact-finding trip to New Mexico, a set of meetings were facilitated with different people. One of them was Governor Richardson. Another was Jack Pruitt, who had been one of the team leaders on Project Pegasus. A third individual I met with, in the parking lot of, this was in June of 2003, of the Wolf Creek Pass Ski Lodge, which obviously was not being frequented because it was the middle of the summer and nobody was skiing. And during that meeting, I was essentially told by a representative of the executive office of the president, this would be George W. Bush's administration, the following. I was basically told that my memories of having been involved in Project Pegasus were valid, that the project involved black technologies that represented sensitive national security secrets, that I was admonished or being advised to cease and desist from investigating my experiences, talking about them, or writing about them, and then if I didn't do that, they couldn't, quote-unquote, guarantee my survival. So by that point into my investigation, I was literally being instructed by the executive branch to terminate my investigation. And I decided not to, primarily because I concluded that we really can't implement our destinies as individuals if we hold on to our fear of death. Achieving great purposes requires basically some form of fearlessness in the sense that you have to let go of worrying about the consequences of what you're doing. And so I resolved then to basically patronize them and tell them, sure, I'll shut up. But then I quietly continued my investigation. It's now gone on for an additional 6 years, during which I've recovered a lot more data. So, yes, I was actively concerned during my investigation that I might be assassinated as a result of investigating what happened to me and then later publishing this expose that goes into one of the more sensitive areas of national security activities, even implicating the U.S. presidency. Regarding your point about my dad, I think it might be helpful to go back and consider who he was. He had been a combat medic during World War II and had seen many children who had been killed in war. He had worked on the ramjet engine in the B-70 strategic bomber immediately after the July 1952 overflight of our nation's capital by, nine disc-shaped craft flying at clocked at 7,000 miles per hour by Langley Air Force Base. So he was profoundly involved in classified aerospace projects that were being launched to protect the people of our planet from any potential threat that the extraterrestrials posed. So he had that degree of concern and involvement in protecting life on Earth, human life. I think it's clear also that he didn't volunteer me into the project. In fact, what happened was he was contacted at work by the U.S. Army and informed that I would be in the project. And that's actually one of the mysteries that I haven't been able to resolve in my investigation. In the final analysis, it remains a mystery as to why I was selected. We know that Admiral Rickover had launched a project called Project Talent in 1959 to identify young Americans who possessed either extraordinary intelligence, psychic ability, or leadership potential, and to cultivate their human abilities in these types of programs, even expose them to defense projects so they could later contribute to them after getting more education. So I think it's safer to identify the fact that I was more identified by Project Talent as somebody the government wanted to work with than I was volunteered into a classified defense project by my dad. It's also clear that at a certain stage, around 1967-68, when I was brought into the project, the U.S. government was already in possession of information about me pertaining to my Mars research. That is to say, I had already been identified as a person of interest, as somebody who, like Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra and all the great pioneers of Mars anomaly research that George has had on the show, that I too would play a part in contributing to that literature. So I think it's a very complicated profile. In fact, my father was approached. He didn't just say, well, let's use my son in this, just because he was one of the project engineers. And then regarding the environmental issue that you raise, this actually came up in a seminar that I took part in. You know, imagine Al Gore is studying with Roger Revelle about global warming at Harvard as an undergraduate at this time. I'm a child participant in Project Pegasus, and we're having a similar discussion. I remember saying during a seminar, well, if we use teleportation, we'll remove from the atmosphere all of those pollutants and particulates that are currently being put into the world's atmosphere by planes, trains, and automobiles. So the environmental significance of teleportation is that it'll allow us to obviate most of the pollution that is currently being contributed to the global atmosphere from transportation. And that's a significant component of the global warming equation. And so,
Andy, why did they call the project Pegasus?
Well, when we were told what the project descriptor was, you know, the project title, and it was explained how classified defense projects are given one name or the other, Project Manhattan, Project Zero, and so forth, Project Montauk. We were told that sometimes the naming was arbitrary, as in the case of Project Manhattan. In the case of Project Pegasus, we were told that the reason that Pegasus was selected is because the technologies would take us over the rainbow, that in the same way that Pegasus in Greek mythology, flew to the summit of Mount Olympus, these technologies would take us into non-ordinary experience, some of which would seem almost magical or fantastic in its reach. And in fact, that is what happened. There were times when I was on Project Pegasus involved in these different forms of quantum access where I literally felt a zeal about what we were doing. I felt like a yo-yo on the end of a string. I had this deep sense of profound enjoyment and excitement about the fact that I was literally on the cutting edge of human experience. Other times, we were experiencing things that were quite terrifying. But I believe that they called the project Project Pegasus because a part of our experience on the project would be accessing non-ordinary realities that would be as magical as Pegasus flying to the summit of Mount Olympus.
Fascinating. Andy, give out your website, would you please?
Right. My Mars writings, and I'm really trying to create an international movement of research associates who will, as I have done in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, show through works of natural history, through photo analysis and text, that Mars is an inhabited planet, and therefore we need to protect it from human beings from Earth. That work is currently up on the Internet. It's an evolving website at projectmars.net. And my cause to try to have the U.S. government declassify teleportation so that we can use it to advantage human beings around our planet is at a site that's just under development right now called projectpegasus.net.
And we will make sure we link all of those for you, Andy. We'll be back in a moment with Craig Hewlett on Coast to Coast AM.